favorite stories about the Gilded Age in the United States. It's that period of industrialization in which the United States came into prominence. We became the greatest economy that the world had ever seen. We were producing more goods and services than all of the rest of the world combined. And this was focused, of course, in the great industrial Northeast, and starting about the middle of the 19th century, but certainly coming to its high point in the 1880s and 90s, people like Carnegie. So those Pennsylvanians in our midst, there, Carnegie Hall and University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon and all various and sundry other kinds of things. Well, this Carnegie, who was born in Scotland, who was a poor little boy growing up in the gutters in the United States, works up to the pinnacle of his might, his financial might, and gave most of it away, as a matter of fact, before he died. It was an astonishing story. And then Rockefeller, of course, a fine Methodist man who was devoted to giving to the poor. He, of course, is the one who finds oil in Pennsylvania. Who knew? I thought it was all in Texas, as a matter of fact. But discovers oil in Pennsylvania, and then proceeds to drive the cost of heating oil for all Americans down to just pennies on the dollar. A great friend of all humanity, another example of the great benefits that come to us from free market trading. But the one that I'm thinking of this morning, my favorite story, is Henry Ford. Henry Ford, of course, the great inventor, not so much of the car as it was the production line to make a car inexpensive. And like all of these other Gilded Age industrialists, they worked their way up from nothing to become the most fabulously wealthy men the world had ever seen. And they all looked back to the old country, thinking about where they had come from. And like Carnegie, Henry Ford, not a Scotsman but an Irishman, decides to go back to the village where his family was from to see how the old folk were living, now that he, of course, was the master of all that he surveyed. And as he arrived, two men who were representatives of the local hospital came to meet him to ask him for a donation to the hospital. And he said, "Well, sure, I'll give you $5,000, which back then was a big pile of money. And the next morning, as he was having his breakfast, he was reading the local newspaper, and it says, "American industrialist Henry Ford gives $50,000 to the local hospital." Of course, he was outraged. "You don't do that. Can you raise him?" Add a zero.
My daughter's had a zero.
Anyway, he was outraged, and he called these two men and shook the newspaper in their faces and said, "What did they think they were doing, taking advantage of him in this way?" And they said they would be sure to fix it. And so the next morning, the newspaper, it said, "Henry Ford reduces his contribution to the local hospital by 95%. Of course, Ford couldn't let that go. And so he called these two tormentors of him back and agreed to the $50,000 figure, but only on the guarantee that in the newly constructed entrance to the hospital, there would be inscribed in the stonework this Bible verse: "I was a stranger and you took me in." There it is. Taking advantage of the stranger. Jesus says similar things about our relationship to wealth and riches. "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." And Americans of all social classes have a great deal of treasure. Even the poorest in our number are vastly wealthier than their counterparts in other countries around the world. And so I want you to think with me briefly today, as we consider the eighth commandment, "Don't steal," about how it is that we relate to our wealth, how we relate to our treasure. Where our treasure is, there our heart will be also, says our Lord Jesus. How do we come by that treasure? What is our relationship to that treasure? And what are the obligations that we have as we have come by such great treasure? All of these questions are regulated by the Eighth Commandment. It is short. Don't kill, don't steal are the two shortest ones in the list. But it builds upon the previous two. As we've seen, the second table of the law all relate to our duty to our neighbor. And so we saw in the sixth commandment that we have an obligation to do our neighbor good, to do him no harm, and to seek his good not only in his name, in his person, and his possessions. Last week, Father Heaton taught us about how we are to guard our minds and our bodies in purity. Don't commit adultery. That we should not take advantage of our neighbor's body, which does not belong to us, but it belongs to the Lord. Each one of us in our bodies belong to the Lord. And so our first obligation as it relates to the use of our bodies is to the Lord. And so we must maintain it in purity. We are not allowed to commit adultery in our bodies. And now we find that in our eighth commandment, we are commanded not to steal. Because of the fact that we have received all of our possessions from the hand of God, and because we have been made in God's image, we exercise his dominion over all of our possessions with prudence and charity, avoiding greed. That is it in a nutshell. The eighth commandment assumes that we have received all of our possessions, all of our treasure, all of our wealth from God. And because he has given it into our hands, we have dominion over it. But we should, in relating to it, do so with prudence and charity and avoid greed. So first then, that God has most certainly given all things into our hands. Being made in God's image means that we have knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. So we have the power of reason, and we also have the power of conscience. We know the difference between good and evil. We are moral agents, and we are responsible for all of our actions. We can't blame other people. God has given us that knowledge. And finally, that God has given us dominion over the world that he has made. That doesn't mean that it's ours to do with what we like. Dominion means that we are stewards over God's great bounty, which is this world and all of its fullness. The oceans, the skies, the waters, the trees. We can't just simply go paving over it and decide that, well, that makes us happier because we don't have to cut the grass anymore. No, we have a responsibility to the world as stewards, but nonetheless, it is ours. We are his representatives here in this world. And of course, this has not been without dispute. Some people have proposed that, as a matter of fact, our dominion is related to the fall. That before human beings had fallen in the garden, that we didn't have a responsibility. Or that we did not have dominion over the creatures, but that all creatures existed equally and without authority over one another. But this is most certainly not true. The fall certainly did pervert our natural, God-given desire, changing our dominion into domination. But that is an effect of the fall. And of course, we have seen that developed over the tyrannous and bloody 20th century more than any other era in the life of human beings here on earth. Powerful men, governments taking over and ruling with cruelty against their own people, grinding their heels into their faces and killing millions in the process. This is not dominion, this is domination. But most certainly, human beings, by virtue of our being given God's image, we have also been given the rule and right to inherit the earth. So Jesus says in his Sermon on the Mount, the meek will inherit the earth. Some have thought that that means that we have no dominion at all. Meekness being something like timidity. And so this is somehow a contradiction in terms, that the only people that get to rule the earth are the timid, the people who have no dominion at all. But this is a misunderstanding of what meekness is. In the language or mind of the scriptures, meekness is not timidity or fear or lack of leadership, but instead the meek are those who are conformed to the will and mind of God. The meek, who will be given the rule over all of God's creation, they are the ones who are most like God. They are the ones who seek to do with the world what God wishes it to be done with. And if they do not, my friends, if the meek do not take dominion over the earth, then you can be sure that the wicked and the tyrant and the murderer will most certainly take the rule, will destroy the earth. It is not avoiding possessions and avoiding our call to dominion is not a virtue. Christians have a job to do, to rule in God's place, to do justly and rightly here among the creatures. So you see then that the eighth commandment assumes private property. There's some question as to whether, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, therefore all human beings given general or common dominion, but not individual or private dominion. But that's most certainly not true. The eighth commandment assumes that private individuals own property. I can't steal anything from Dr. Curtis if he doesn't own it. Think about it that way. If it's his lawnmower, which he has a fine, fine lawnmower, I'd like to add. If he has a fine lawnmower, if I take it from him and simply it is general or common in use, then I'm not stealing it at all. But if I go and take it without his permission, and I go do with it what I like, perhaps selling it, so that I can go on a nice vacation, and it is his, truly his, private property, then I have broken the eighth commandment. I have stolen or taken what is not mine, because it is his. If all things are held in common, then they cannot be stolen, but simply used in common for anyone's advantage. And of course, this is contrary then to all various and sundry kinds of socialistic and communistic philosophies, that the great and golden age of humanity will be when all people own all things in common. But that's most certainly not true, because we could not then steal. And our commandment tells us as much, that we cannot take our brother's property without their permission. But what about the early church? I mean, Acts chapter 2 is pretty clear that they held all things in common. And some have proposed that this early communistic experience among the Christians in Jerusalem is an example of what all Christians should aspire to. But I would offer to you that was a very special case, that the Christians in Jerusalem in the years immediately after Jesus' ascension were expecting the imminent and final judgment of Jerusalem. Jesus had said as much, that God would show or vindicate Jesus in all of his claims to be the king of Israel. What should they expect to see? That Jerusalem would be destroyed. All Christians living in Jerusalem knew that they were living on borrowed time. Property, ownership in a disaster zone is only useful for survival, not for ownership. They were using each one, sharing in whatever they were able to in moments that they believed would end shortly. So how do we break the eighth commandment? How do we keep the eighth commandment? Well, I'm sure that you all have hurt your arms and shoulders already. Pat yourselves in the back that you have not stolen anything today or in recent memory, or no highway robbers in here or anything like that. But I would offer to you that the eighth commandment goes deeper than that. How do we break the eighth commandment? First of all, sloth. Sloth is breaking the commandment, being lazy. Proverbs, the 31st chapter, says it this way: I passed by the field of a sluggard, by the vineyard of a man lacking sense, and behold, it was all overgrown with thorns. The ground was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. And then I saw and considered it. I looked and received instruction, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man. Being lazy means that you're robbing yourself. Have you thought about it that way? You have a job to do. God gave you a life to live. As Father Heaton reminded us last week, especially the ladies here, if any young man proposes marriage to you and he doesn't have a job, tell him to go get a job or get out of your face. Okay? He is not an appropriate match for you. Labor, getting a job, is one of God's greatest blessings to us. And if we refuse to work, as Paul says later in the New Testament, you should eat. You shouldn't feel entitled. In fact, you shouldn't be entitled by other people to simply sit and be lazy. We are called to work hard. We are entitled to the results of that, which is a wage. Perhaps a large wage, a great and wealthy wage, in response to work well done. We are responsible to provide for our wives and our children. We are also responsible to save for the future. Savings and accrued wealth to provide not only for ourselves, but also the generations that will come as God blesses us with children and grandchildren are not a curse, but a blessing. And those who are lazy, slothful, and avoid these kinds of opportunities that God places in our way, they are committing the sin of robbery. They're robbing themselves. But not only sloth, but also greed. Greed is a way in which we break the eighth commandment. Greed, to be clear, is an intense and selfish desire for something that you don't have. I don't want to burn up all of my gunpowder for covetousness. We'll come back to that here in a couple of weeks. But nonetheless, greed is an intense and selfish desire for something that you don't have, whether it be wealth or position or privilege. Greed is wishing that you had something that somebody else has. For other people's belongings. And we often hear this language of greed used in a little bit different way today, but it is all around us. The demand for a fair share is greedy language. The expectation that everybody should have equal access to all people's belongings. And even worse than that, people who use that language of fair share as they entitle or empower the government to use their power to take things from other people through taxation, and also the devaluing of your money. That's the most insidious and destructive power that the government has. You thought it was driving up in your front yard in an armored personnel carrier with a machine gun. It's actually not. The most insidious or destructive power the government has is they keep making your money worth less and less all the time. They are destroying you because of what they are doing. And this is greed on the power of the government. But not only is it this language of fair share and empowering the government to do that for you, to rob other people on your behalf, but also the language of disparaging wealth, as if having possessions is somehow evil or wicked or criminal. That because of the fact that you are, air quotes, wealthy, that you are somehow criminal and should be defeated by all of the powers available to other people. To disparage wealth, we must be clear from the outset, I've tried to be over these last few minutes, that wealth is a gift from God. We see throughout the scriptures that God blesses his people with wealth. Abraham was a vastly wealthy man. Isaac, when he heard the word of God and remained in the land, was blessed, not simply directly from the hands of God, but from the Amalekites and the Amorites, who were his neighbors, who gave him all of their stuff because he was a righteous man. Job is an incredibly good example of how it is that God blesses the righteous man. The Psalms speak throughout about how God blesses his people with wealth. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who greatly delights in his commandments. His offspring will be mighty in the land. The generation of the upright will be blessed. Wealth and riches are in his house, and his righteousness endures forever. Psalm 112. It is not a sin to own things. It does not make you criminal to be wealthy. As a matter of fact, I would go so far as to say that your possessions are neutral. They have no moral value. The Bible only speaks of good or evil men and women. Their possessions have no moral value. There is no rich or poor in God's kingdom. It's only those who follow the covenant and those who reject the covenant. That's who we find the Bible talking about. Jesus condemned the Pharisees not because of the fact that they were wealthy, but because they loved their money and they rejected Jesus. Jesus judged and condemned the Sadducees because they loved power and prestige and they were in a conspiracy with Herod and the Romans. He didn't condemn them for their wealth. So how do we break the commandment? Sloth and greed. And finally, injustice. Injustice. Cicero defines justice as giving everyone what they deserve, what they do. What does your yard man deserve from you? Well, as we've already established, Dr. Curtis doesn't have a yard man. He is his own yard man. But nonetheless, you may not get your yard man to work for you and then tell him, I'll pay you next month. Your yard man depends upon you being good and not paying him. And we can just simply extrapolate that across an economy. The wealthy may not take advantage of the poor. That is example number one of breaking the Eighth Commandment. The wealthy may not rob the poor. If you owe someone something, you can't say, you know, I'll get to that when I can. Now, you can make a negotiated payment with someone, but you can't just simply defraud them. Often, the passage from James is thrown in the face of Christians saying, look here how James criticizes the wealthy. I'll read it to you. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Behold the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. It's not that they're rich. It's not that they're rich Christians. It's the fact that they're rich and they're not paying what they owe. They're defrauding the poor. They're leaving the poor man homeless. They're leaving him without food for himself and for his children. That's injustice. And we ought to speak out against that every chance that we get. Not giving others what they are due, oppressing them according to not paying them new wages, which they have worked for, and also oppressing them in courts, using your power, your influence, to twist justice system in your favor when the poor have no place to go. This is what is being condemned in this passage and by the Eighth Commandment. My friends, the justice of the world hangs upon the Eighth Commandment, that we respect others in their possessions and not take from them what is not ours. So Calvin, the great reformer, says that it is the magistrate's responsibility to each one of us as citizens to remind us that this law, the Eighth Commandment, is ordained for our hearts as much as for our hands, in order that men may study both to protect the property of others and to promote their interests. Think about a society like that, that it is your responsibility to care for the good success of your neighbor, that when you use illegal means, when you chisel away in the shadows in the back room or the back alley to take advantage of others, you're stealing from them. Even if you don't use your own hand or don't have a pistol pointed in their face, whether it be using the overwhelming power of the government to take it from someone else, or whether you just simply take from them by running them down, running their reputation down, you are stealing from them. So our job, our calling as Christians, is to keep the Eighth Commandment, to love our neighbor, to seek his advancement, to seek his conversion, so that he may enjoy the wealth that God will pour out upon all of his people. Amen.